Applications for the Thomistic Institute's Study Abroad Program's Spring 2025 semester close on March 20th. This is a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity for college students to explore Rome's intellectual tradition at the Pontifical University of St. Thomas Aquinas. Limited spots are available. For more information, visit thomisticinstitute.org/Rome. That's thomisticinstitute.org/Rome.
Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at thomisticinstitute.org.
Thank you, Reed. Thank you, Hyden. Thank you, Reed, for that lovely introduction, and thank you for the Thomistic Institute, and thank you all for being here. Okay, so I am going to talk about Smerdyakov and in the context of the Brothers Karamazov and the problem of evil. So this is a favorite topic of mine, not only mine, of course. In fact, when people speak about this topic, the usual focus, if you're talking about Brothers K and the problem of evil, the usual focus is Ivan's tirade against God in three particular chapters of the book, and I am going to say something about that, but I want to take a somewhat different angle on this problem. I want, after making a few general comments about Ivan, I want to veer into this odd and endlessly fascinating character of Smerdyakov. And I'm going to assume that everybody has read the book or at least has some familiarity with it. So after briefly highlighting a few points about Ivan's rebellion against God, I will switch to Smerdyakov, who has a lot to do with Ivan. And a hint about the view is the subtitle of this talk, whether Smerdyakov is unloved by God. Now, Dostoevsky was quite explicit in calling this novel his last, and by common assent, his finest, a novel about children. Children do figure into at least one of the subplots of the novel, which is the story of Ilyusha Snirgiryov, the son of Captain Snirgiryov. But aside from this subplot, I'd like to mention two other main ways in which children come into the novel. The first of these is that the three Karamazov brothers, and I'm hoping this is not a spoiler, possibly a fourth one, were once children, and they were not treated very well. The action of the novel starts when the three legitimate brothers, who grew up mostly apart and mostly away from their parental home, meet and get to know one another as adults at their father's home. In the interest of time, I'm going to say very little about Dmitri, who was actually a half-brother of Ivan and Alyosha, same father, different mother. So I'll move to the other two, Ivan and Alyosha, before turning to Smerdyakov. Now, at the start of the novel, Alyosha was in a monastery devoted to an elder, Father Zosima. Ivan, on the other hand, had a brilliant mind, went to the university through the generosity of some distant relations, and studied natural science. He was, by reputation at least, an atheist, though I would say that the situation is not so simple as that. The reason that the brothers had spent little of their childhood together was that their father, Fyodor Pavlovich, was, to put the matter rather bluntly, a low, degenerate swine. Though saying that, I think, is very unfair to pigs. The personalities of Ivan and Alyosha were night and day. Alyosha was beloved by everyone and seemed to love everyone. Though the narrator stresses that this does not mean that he was in any way a simpleton. Ivan, on the other hand, realized that he was living on the charity of others and grew up kind of morose and withdrawn and resentful. Now, in the novel, Ivan and Alyosha meet and get to talk to one another. And these three chapters that I've highlighted on the bottom of the slide are, in a sense, the theological and philosophical core of the novel. Particularly the chapters, The Brothers Get Acquainted and Rebellion. And again, in the interest of time, I'm not going to say very much about the last of these three, The Grand Inquisitor. By the way, I keep mentioning time because I have my wife's voice in my ears telling me, you always put it in too many slides, try to cover too much. So she's right. My wife is always right, by the way. Just want to say that. Okay, and she'll enjoy hearing that I say that. Now, in an early chapter called Over the Cognac, the father, Fyodor Pavlovich, is talking with Alyosha and Ivan. But importantly, Smerdyakov, he was basically employed as a lackey in the Karamazov home. And he was there as well. He doesn't say very much, but he takes it all in. Okay? Here is what Ivan and Alyosha say to their father's inquiries. Well, basically, the father says, and he's a bit of a buffoon, he says, is there a God? And Alyosha says, yes, there is. But Ivan says, no, there is no God. Any kind of immortality, not of any kind. Completely zero, completely zero. Well, that would seem to settle it. But then, in a later chapter, one of the two I mentioned, the brothers get acquainted. They are talking in a tavern. And so Ivan says this, and I'm just going to highlight some of it. I said that on purpose yesterday at dinner with the old man just to tease you. So imagine that perhaps I too accept God, Ivan laughed. That comes as a surprise to you, eh? And Alyosha really is no simpleton, and he says, yes, of course, unless you're joking again. So I think in the end, one does not know what Ivan thinks. And this is compounded by the fact that we read about, but don't read the actual article he wrote, in which he defends the rights of church government over civic government. Now, in my opinion, the reason that we don't know what Ivan thinks is exactly that Ivan does not know what Ivan thinks. He's very confused. In spite of his intellectual brilliance, or maybe in part because of his intellectual brilliance. The one that I think summarized it best about Ivan was Father Zosima, who says that in Ivan, the issues of God and immortality were, quote, not yet resolved in his heart, and that torments it, his heart. Okay, so now talking to Alyosha, Ivan is a good rhetorician, and he sets the stage for his argument. He says, my task is to explain to you as quickly as possible what sort of man I am, and therefore I declare that I accept God pure and simple. But, now already, the reason the word but is in red is that if it's pure and simple, there's no buts, right? But he has a but. But this, however, needs to be noted. If God exists and if he indeed created the earth, then as we all know perfectly well, he created it in accordance with Euclidean geometry, and he created human reason with a conception of only three dimensions of space. Now, Ivan knows, and in fact later alludes to, although he doesn't name this particular man, who is Nikolai Lobachevsky, who had in 1829, the novel takes place in the 1860s, so this is not news. He had famously taken aim at Euclid's fifth postulate to develop non-Euclidean geometry, what was hyperbolic geometry. Now, for those of you who are not mathematically inclined, Euclid's fifth postulate is the one that says, in effect, that parallel lines never meet. Mathematicians had been worried about the fifth postulate for a very long time because no one had ever been able to prove it. So not only Lobachevsky, but a number of others took aim at this postulate and said, okay, it's an unproved postulate. Let's say it's not true. And they developed other kinds of geometry instead. So the question is, why would Ivan play dumb, or at least play ignorant, about something he almost certainly knew about? The reality, I think, is that this is a rhetorical ploy. Joseph Frank refers to Ivan's argument that I just gave you here as the devil's swindle, trying to understand God in human terms. His goal, Ivan's, I would say, is to take God to task. Now, it's relatively easy to get over Euclidean geometry. They don't want to see my face. It's relatively easy to get over a Euclidean geometry, but getting over evil is a good deal harder. And that is if one starts with the premise of an all-powerful and all-good God. So taking such a stance as Ivan's is to judge God by human standards. Now, I believe it's fair to wonder whether a solution to the problem of evil exists. And in fact, as many readers have observed about the brothers Karamazov, nowhere in the novel is there a second tirade to counter Ivan's very powerful tirade. If Dostoevsky did indeed answer it, it is not in kind with a tirade. And I think he did answer it, but it is through the examples of Father Zosima and Alyosha, who went into the world, Alyosha anyway, and practiced what Zosima called active love. Now let's jump to the chase now and state the problem of evil in a couple of typical formulations. This particular one is from Boethius. He actually got it from Tertullian in the Consolation of Philosophy. Boethius was, by all accounts, a good and decent man who got a political stab in the back and was exiled and then executed. But while in exile, he wrote this book, and in it, he addresses a personification of philosophy, a woman with some of the features of Athena. So here is his statement of the problem of evil. If God exists, whence evil? Now, I'm displaying it this way because oftentimes when people state the problem of evil, they state it this way, and that's fine. But in Boethius, importantly, there's a second half to it, which is, if God does not exist, where does the good come from? And, you know, yes, tomorrow I'm going to talk about biotechnology, and I think when you talk about human nature and meddling with it, that becomes an extremely important question. Okay, so let's fill out the question a little bit. This is from Lucretius, who claimed to be quoting Epicurus. You may also have seen it in David Hume's Dialogues Concerning Natural Religion, where he quotes Lucretius. And the problem with it, I'm sure this is familiar to you in some formulation like this, the problem is that this is the part of the reason it's so thorny is that it's a trilemma, not a dilemma. It's a bit like playing whack-a-mole. You attack the goodness of God, and then the power of God pops up, or vice versa. So it's a very, very thorny problem. And David Hume, who wanted to sow skepticism, found this particular formulation very congenial. Okay, so now let's get back to Brothers Karamazov. And when Ivan, the chapter starts, when Ivan says, rebellion chapter starts, when Ivan says two things to the novice Alyosha, first he runs directly counter to church dogma by noting that he finds it impossible to love one's neighbor. I must make a confession, Yvonne began. I could never understand how it's possible to love one's neighbor. And he then talks about a saint, John the Merciful, who took care of a frozen beggar, which Yvonne will have the opportunity to do later in the novel. He passes it up the first time, but not the second. But I want to point out here that the legend he's talking about, or the story he's talking about, is not actually out of the life of John the Merciful. It's out of Gustave Flaubert's great novella, La Légende de Julien l'Hospitalier. Now, why does Dostoevsky have Ivan switch the name from Julien to John? Well, of course, Ivan is the Russian form of John. So the significance of this switch is that he's identifying Ivan with Julien, and Julien was a parasite. He killed his father. So Ivan might also be a parasite. All that, by the way. Now, quite early in the novel, we meet a character, one of Dostoevsky's famous buffoon characters named Madame Khokhlakov, and even the name is supposed to be funny. She is, in some respects, not many, but some respects, something of a double for Fyodor Pavlovich Karamazov. Dostoevsky often had his buffoon characters introduce the most serious questions in his novel. And in this particular case, the question is faith. The chapter title is A Lady of Little Faith, and she is the lady in question. During the chapter, Zosima tells this story of a doctor who said, "I love mankind, but I'm amazed at myself. The more I love mankind in general, the less I love people in particular." And in a sense, this is Zosima's main theme, to distinguish abstract, theoretical love, which is cheap and easy, versus actually putting it into effect and making it active, which is hard. Okay, so now, Ivan, the next thing he says is, "I meant to talk about the suffering of mankind in general, but better let us dwell only on the suffering of children. The more unprofitable for me, of course." Well, nonsense. This shows how good a rhetorician Ivan is. It's making his case easier. If you can't make people feel for suffering children, who can you make them feel for? So yes, he's a good rhetorician. Now, he continues and says, "One can love children even close up, even dirty or homely children. It seems to me, however, that children are never homely. I will not speak of grown-ups, because apart from the fact that they are disgusting and do not deserve love, they have retribution. They ate the apple and knew good and evil and became as gods, and they still go on even eating. But little children have not eaten anything and are not yet guilty of anything." Now, I want to make a couple of points. It's a little bit of a digression, which is, again, this is, he's a little bit of a misanthrope sometimes. He gets very disgusted with people. But you might be surprised to see Ivan say that adults are guilty of eating the apple, meaning original sin, but children are not. Now, this digression, most of you, I imagine, are accustomed to Augustine's very categorical view of original sin, including the infamous contention that unbaptized children go to hell as a consequence of original sin. Now, such infants, he said, are guilty even without having done anything themselves, which was his interpretation of Paul's letter to the Roman, this particular verse, that that sin entered the world through one man and death through sin, and it was in this way death came to all people because all sinned. So he says very explicitly, all sinned. Now, although Augustine's views have been largely incorporated into the Western Church, including the Catholic Church, this is not the case for the Eastern churches, including the Russian Orthodox Church, which takes a much less categorical view. In the Eastern Church, one becomes guilty as one enters the world. In other words, children mature and enter adulthood, and what we inherited from Adam is a tendency towards sin, but not the sin itself. And when we come to the views of Thomas Aquinas, it turns out that his views are probably closer to that of the Eastern Church than to that of Augustine. Thomas calls original sin a habit, not a sin which is an act. So in typical Thomistic fashion, he parses out the word habit into its different senses, but to cut to the chase, what we have inherited from Adam is what he called the languor of nature. And let me do a little bit of geeky linguistics here. The word Augustine used more often was vitiation, which means kind of the same thing as languor, but he more often called it vitiation of languor, of nature, which became his term, second nature to us, and that is what we have inherited, according to Thomas Aquinas. And here's the quote that what we have inherited is an inordinate disposition of nature. And I have much, much, much more to say about what that means. I think it's what it means to be a human being is to have that sense of guilt and responsibility, which is, if you will, the inheritance of this disposition. But that, and I cannot help but emphasize this point, that Thomas also ties bodily sickness as a inordinate disposition of the body by equilibrium of the destruction of that equilibrium, which is essential to health. And he analogizes that to original sin. Okay, and that is all I'm going to say about Ivan, except when it comes to Smerdyakov. Now, okay, so who is Smerdyakov, and is he a human being? Well, to answer that question, at least straightforwardly, yes, of course he's a human being, but there are also reasons to hesitate or hedge that statement. And to give it an apt analogy, the devil might have been created by God, but the devil can make one doubt God's wisdom in doing so. So who is Smerdyakov? His actual name, is Pavel Fyodorovich Smerdyakov. And he may have been the illegitimate son of Fyodor Pavlovich Karamazov. So this is, again, the patriarch of the Karamazov family. Now, this is one more piece of what Dostoevsky referred to, starting in the novel that precedes Brothers Karamazov, called The Adolescent. He called it The Accidental Family. So this is one more piece of that. And the three brothers, as I mentioned, they spent their childhood away from their paternal home, and this was no place to grow up. But ironically, Smerdyakov was the one who stayed. Why? Because the father would pay no attention to him, but he was basically adopted by two trusty servants of the patriarch, Fyodor Pavlovich. Their names are Grigory and his wife, Marfa. Now, it is simplest to assume that Fyodor Pavlovich was Smerdyakov's father, but Dostoevsky very cleverly peppers the novel with just enough evidence to cast doubt on the claim. It's very interesting what he does there. The claim seems to center on a few strands of rather circumstantial evidence. I mean, nowadays we do a DNA test, but of course in 1860s and 1870s, not possible. So the first strand of circumstantial evidence comes from a chapter entitled Stinking Lizaveta. And that was the name by which Smerdyakov's mother was generally called. And so there is this scene in which Fyodor Pavlovich is coming home drunk with a bunch of, quote, gentlemen. No quotes there, but you can imagine the air quotes. And they come across stinking Lizaveta, and they ask an impossible, bizarre question on an impossible subject. Could anyone possibly regard such an animal as a woman right now, for instance? And Fyodor Pavlovich popped up and declared, yes, she could be regarded as a woman, even very much so, and that there was even some piquancy in it of a special sort and so forth. Now, as the narrator notes, that he was overzealously establishing himself as a buffoon, his reputation as a buffoon. Now, before we get more onto Smerdyakov, let's note that this narrator is an unreliable narrator. Why do I say that? He is far from omniscient, he usually hedges all of his statements. He doesn't know this for sure. He doesn't know for sure if Fyodor Pavlovich is the father of Smerdyakov. But when Lizaveta becomes pregnant, suspicion falls on him, and he never admits to being the father. Nor does the narrator inform us that there was anything more between them than some tasteless buffoonery. For what it's worth, Grigory, the servant of Fyodor Pavlovich, he's faithful, if also a little bit obstinate and stupid. He takes his master's part and says, no, it wasn't my master. It was another plausible suspect who was in the town at the time named Karp the convict. Okay, so that's one piece of circumstantial evidence. The second piece is that Lizaveta gives birth to her son in Fyodor Pavlovich's backyard. So she climbs over the fence and gives birth to the child there. However, she slept everywhere and anywhere in the town, often on the cathedral porch, for example. She refused to be housed. She refused to be properly clothed. One evening then in May, Grigory and Marfa were awakened, or actually Marfa was awakened, quote, by the wail of a newborn baby. She awakened her husband, who said, ironically, in view of Fyodor Pavlovich's coarse remarks, it might be a woman. Okay? So Grigory goes to investigate, and he opens the bathhouse door, and there is baby Smerdyakov. And the baby was lying beside her. She was dying in childbirth. And she said nothing for the simple reason that she had never been able to speak. Grigory and Marfa, Marfa is clearly the brighter of the two, but in the matter of the time and place, she usually deferred to her husband. And the couple had previously lost their only son in infancy. He died presumably from multiple internal deficits. And I want to spend a little bit of time on this particular point. What is the basis for saying that? Well, Grigory was quite shaken, didn't want to have the child baptized. Why? Because, quote, it's a dragon. Now, what he means by that is that there's a sixth finger. This, I can tell you, was a very, very common occurrence. What obstetricians do right now is they tie off the blood supply and the supernumerary finger falls off, and then there's only five fingers. But it's mostly cosmetic. It's not any real problem. This child probably had more than that going on. But my point is that the child was sickly, died of thrush infection after only 2 weeks of life. But that was the reason Grigory declared the child a dragon. And he looked upon Smerdyakov as a replacement for his dead son. Now, what we have, therefore, is a transformation of a child of Grigory and Marfa, who Grigory thinks is a dragon, followed by Smerdyakov. Now, who follows Smerdyakov? In the novel, if you think about the topos, the place that character occupies, just when Smerdyakov dies, that is when the devil appears in the novel. So we have dragon to Smerdyakov to devil. The phrase here that Grigory was somewhat inclined to mysticism indicates some of the narrator's view of religion, which I would call ambivalent. And bear in mind, there's a big question in the field about whether the narrator of this novel is Dostoevsky or a local character. I'll give you my opinion, which is that he's a character, not Dostoevsky, but that is open to much debate. Okay, so he was dubbed. He was dubbed Pavel Fyodorovich Smerdyakov. Now, the townspeople, not Fyodor Pavlovich the patriarch, but the townspeople, gave him that middle name, which in Russian, that's named after the father. It's called the patronymic. So they said Fyodorovich because Fyodor was the father. But Fyodor never admitted it. Fyodor Pavlovich never admitted it. Now, as for his last name, that was a drollery invented by the patriarch Fyodor Pavlovich because the mother's patronymic is Smerdyashaya, which is not a real patronymic because we know that her father was named Ilya. But what does Smerdyashaya mean? It means basically stinking. Okay, so her real name is Lizaveta, and then two made up names. Okay? Her father, homeless and sickly, a failed trained person, and then he died. And but I want to come to the end of this quote, which is that she would not be clothed or housed. In the winter, she wore only a sheepskin. The people tried to put a coat on her, but she always threw it off. If you gave her some money, she would give it to the poor, and no one was as poor financially than she was. But that's how she went around. So that is the mother of Smerdyakov, then raised by Grigory and Marfa, became a lackey in the Karamazov house. And I think it's fair game to interpret Smerdyakov's personality traits in the modern fashion, psychodynamically, sociologically, and as being the result of mistreatment during his childhood. However, and that's in line with what we know of Dostoevsky's social conscience, but I think there's more to the story. Ivan and Alyosha are the way they are from the start. And that's something that Dostoevsky do. He gives characters in pairs. It's part of what Mikhail Bakhtin, the great Russian literary critic, called Dostoevsky's dialogical style method. And so Ivan and Alyosha, yes, they grew up and they had personalities developed, but they're arranged in pairs. Now, Smerdyakov is not arranged in a pair. He's all by his lonesome. One thing about the pairs, let me come back to Ivan and Alyosha. There is one instance earlier in the novel when Fyodor Pavlovich is drunk and carrying on, and Alyosha is getting more and more upset. And all of a sudden, he gets up and starts having a shrieking fit. And this is very much like the ones his own mother used to have. And so Fyodor Pavlovich says, Ivan, quick, give him water. It's like her, just like her. His mother did the same thing. Spray him with water from your mouth. That's what I used to do with her. It's on account of his mother. His mother, he muttered to Ivan. And Ivan says, this is a great line. He says, but my mother, I think, was also his mother. Wouldn't you agree? Poor Ivan. I mean, everyone loves Alyosha, and Ivan is not loved in the same way. So I think there is, from the start, characterological differences. And Fyodor Pavlovich being what he is, "What do you mean your mother?" he muttered, not understanding. "What are you talking about? Whose mother was she?" "Ah, damn, of course she was yours too." Father of the year, right? Okay, so let's compare Smerdyakov, who's not paired off, with his closest relative, aside from his mother, whose identity is not, aside from his father, whose identity is not as certain, let's compare him with the mother. Smerdyakov is, I think, something of an Ivan Manke. And if you want to trace the lineage through the father, Fyodor Pavlovich. But the interesting thing about Lizaveta, they call her stinking, and she probably did literally stink, but everyone loved her. Everyone loved her. So I think if we want to make that pairing, we have an Ivan Manke and an Alyosha Manke in some sense. And, you know, when her father died and she became literally an orphan, that endeared her to the townspeople even more. Oops, we're going the wrong way. Here we go. Okay. So, Stinking Lizaveta was one of many characters in Dostoevsky's novels with the traits of the Eurodivi, the holy fool. In addition to her, in Brothers Karamazov alone, Ivan and Alyosha's mother, Sofia Ivanovna, was identified as a holy fool. And I think there are several other characters who have some of the traits of the holy fool. I would put Father Ferapont in that, perhaps Father Zosima, and even Alyosha into this pool, at least to some extent. You find them in many of Dostoevsky's novels. For example, Sofia Semyonova Marmeladovna, Dova, rather, in Crime and Punishment, Prince Mishkin in The Idiot, Maria Lebedkin in Demons, Makar Dolgunrukiy in The Adolescent. They have, to some degree, some of the traits of the holy fool. In Russian tradition, the holy fool would speak in riddles, was often to be a prophet, or more superstitiously, to have the power of clairvoyance. Lizaveta, of course, was unable to speak. But this tradition is not limited to Dostoevsky. For example, in Tolstoy's Childhood, Boyhood, and Youth, the character of Grisha is a holy fool as well. And of course, where does this tradition come from? It comes from St. Paul's statement, "We are fools for Christ's sake, but you are wise in Christ." The madness was ambiguous. It could be real or feigned. Sometimes it was socially disruptive, though at the same time, perhaps attributed with having divine inspiration. We can say of Dostoevsky's holy fools that, like Lizaveta, they're not happy in the socially conventional state sense, but they show a kind of blessedness that precludes the miserable ends that Ivan or Smerdyakov suffered. Okay, so now back to Smerdyakov again. And I mentioned this about Ivan, and let's go on to the next point here.
I want to contrast Ivan and Smerdyakov. Smerdyakov somewhat resembles Ivan, but obviously lacks his depth. Ivan is refined, Smerdyakov is crude. Ivan jeers at religion, but he thinks there's a thought behind it, and here is again that quote from Father Zosima, who says, "It's still not resolved in your heart." Okay, so now let's talk about Smerdyakov. How does he react to religion? So consider, for example, this instance in which Grigory is trying to teach him some religion, and Smerdyakov, all by himself, discovers what he considers to be a contradiction in Genesis. And the child suddenly grinned. The boy suddenly grinned. "What is it?" asked Grigory, looking at him sternly. "Nothing, sir. The Lord God created light on the first day and the sun, moon, and stars on the fourth day. Where did the light come from on the first day?" Grigory was dumbfounded. The boy looked derisively at his teacher. There was something supercilious in his look. Now, where he got this from, of course, is from Ivan. And as we later learn, but this word supercilious is attached to Smerdyakov. He's haughty. He's found something. Later on, Ivan has a series of interviews with Smerdyakov. After the murder of Fyodor Pavlovich, Smerdyakov had feigned an epileptic seizure during it as an alibi. And later, he has a real epileptic seizure. Now, it's kind of interesting that Dostoevsky, there are three characters in Dostoevsky's fiction who have epilepsy. One of them is Smerdyakov. The other two are Kirillov and, I'm blanking now on the third one, Kirillov and Demons. And, well, it'll come to me. I'll telephone you each at 3 in the morning when it comes to me. So, after the second, the real seizure, Ivan finally begins to understand what Smerdyakov has been doing all along, and to grasp that Smerdyakov considered Ivan to be in league with him. And I hope this is not a spoiler for the people in the room, but Smerdyakov was the murderer of Fyodor Pavlovich. Now, I think the obvious point is Ivan's state of denial, in which he had managed to ignore what Smerdyakov had been doing rather transparently all along. But let's look at this quote here. This is Smerdyakov talking, "but I don't want to lie to you because if, as I see it now, you really didn't understand anything before this and weren't pretending so as to shift your obvious guilt onto me right to my face, still you are guilty of everything, sir, because you knew about the murder and you told me to kill him, sir, and knowing everything, you left." He went for a business trip, Ivan did. "Therefore, I want to prove it to your face tonight." And he goes on, that in all this, the chief murderer is you alone, sir. And I'm just not the real chief one, sir, though I did kill him. It's you who are the most lawful murderer. Now, I think the striking features of this speech are, first, the absolute moral incoherence of the speech. Smerdyakov is trying to exculpate himself, even though he also does say, "though I did kill him." But the exculpation, if one wants to call it that, is that Smerdyakov is trying to shift the blame for the murder onto Ivan. So if Smerdyakov really is trying to excuse himself, he's trying to do so by blaming everything on Ivan's mentorship. Now, just before this, Alyosha has been at pains to convince Ivan, even before his interviews with Smerdyakov, that he, Ivan, was not, in fact, the murderer. Ivan already feels some guilt feelings for this. Well, harboring hatred towards one's father, might be a sin, but it's not identical to murder. There are degrees of sin. And Alyosha has been called a realist by the narrator several times, which he also called Zosima. But Alyosha, being a realist, is able to make this type of distinction. And so here, what Dostoevsky shows, among other things, is that Smerdyakov is a powder keg just waiting for a spark from Ivan. So one must be very careful in instructing people. To Smerdyakov,
Ivan had permitted or even instigated the murder. That's Smerdyakov's point of view, by introducing to him the notion that all things are lawful or all things are permitted. Now, the ostensible motive is 3,000 rubles, and there's kind of a motif that runs throughout this in the novel of the 3,000 rubles. Not necessarily the same 3,000 rubles all the time. But in this interview, Smerdyakov says to Ivan, take the money, I don't need it. And so it shows that the money is of little relevance. Now, he says, more you taught me that everything is permitted. So now, did you figure it out for yourself? Ivan grinned crookedly. With your guidance, sir. So now you've come to believe in God since you're giving back the money? No, sir, I haven't come to believe. Now, I'm dwelling on this point because where was the money? It was sitting under a book, which was Grigory's book, The Sayings of the Holy Father Isaac the Syrian. And this is next to Smerdyakov's bed. So some people have interpreted this as Smerdyakov has repented of his atheistic ways and has become religious. But I think this statement tells us that that's not really true. And there's no real reason to believe that he's using the book for anything other than to cover the money. And when he doesn't want the money anymore, he just uncovers the money. And I think there's this great quote after this, which is his incredible insouciance as he confesses to Ivan, who clearly is more shaken than Smerdyakov. You used to be brave once, sir. Used to say everything is permitted, sir. Now you've got so frightened, Smerdyakov muttered, marveling. Would you like some lemonade? I'll tell them to bring it, sir. It's very refreshing. Only I must cover up that first. He's hiding the money from his girlfriend, Mandria Kondratievna. Okay, so two questions present themselves at this point. And the first is, why does Smerdyakov commit suicide shortly after this, in the third interview? And if Smerdyakov is not truly troubled by his crimes, nor in despair about his separation from God, what is he in despair about? And I think another motive can be dismissed. He might be worried that Ivan will testify against him, but he's not really worried about that. He says, look, I don't think you're going to testify, but even if you do, no one will believe you. And he's right about that. The second question is, why did Smerdyakov kill Fyodor Pavlovich? And of course, everybody hated Fyodor Pavlovich to some extent. I would have said Dmitri is most likely followed by Ivan, but it was Smerdyakov who did so. So why did he do so? And I think, again, he's not really that interested in the money. Now, all of these motives to make the murder are, to use the term, overdetermined. But in a strange way, it's also a little underdetermined because none of the motives seems quite to carry the day. So to answer the question, I think one comes back to the first question I mentioned, which is Smerdyakov a human being? And again, in a straightforward way, of course he is. But I think one should interpret this question not only from the biological point of view. And I think two vignettes from earlier in the novel will put this question into some perspective. First is this one. This is Dostoevsky's first description of Smerdyakov. This is just precedes the chapter in which Smerdyakov gets his mirthless satisfaction in discovering the contradiction in Genesis, as he calls it, a contradiction. So
Here, he is identified with Balaam's ass. And I'm not going to read the whole thing and take the time, but go to the bottom here where he doesn't like us, the monster. Grigory used to say to Marfa Ignatievna, and he doesn't like anyone. You think you're a human being? He would suddenly address Smerdyakov directly. You are not a human being. You were begotten of bathhouse slime. That's who you are. Smerdyakov, it turned out later, could never forgive him these words. Now, this is, of course, a terrible thing for Grigory to say, and it adds fuel to Smerdyakov's resentment. But I think the question is supposed to stick in our mind, not that Grigory is supposed to be the philosophical spokesman for the novel, but the real question Dostoevsky is raising here is, what is it, aside from biology, that makes a human being a human being? And I think here are four traits that we typically associate with human beings that are lacking in Smerdyakov. Sociality, language, he's taciturn, he doesn't like to talk. Imagination, he's given fiction to read, doesn't like it because it's untrue. Then he's given history to read, and he doesn't like that either. He doesn't really have much imagination. And the question we have to ask is whether he loves anybody, and I would say probably not. Now, the narrator calls Smerdyakov lacking in sociability, unsociable, but he's not literally devoid of all sociality. And I want to consider the two examples. Oh, I'm sorry. There's one thing I have to point out here. Before we go on, there's this absolutely brilliant detail here, which is that as a child, Smerdyakov was fond of hanging cats and burying them with ceremony. He would put on a sheet which served him as a vestment. And you may know this about mass murderers, but an incredible number of them have a childhood history of cruelty to animals. This is true, for example, of Richard Kuklinski, Jeffrey Dahmer, Dennis Rader, and quite a few others. Okay, sorry for that digression here. Okay, so I'm going to skip this in the interest of time because we are running out of time. He has these seizures. He's sent to Moscow to learn how to be a cook. And I think, don't think of firebrand like Gordon Ramsay. He's here to follow recipes, lack of imagination. And what Fyodor Pavlovich doesn't like about his epileptic seizures is that if he has one, he can't cook. And so he says, how about we get you married? And Smerdyakov gets very annoyed at that. Fyodor Pavlovich asks Smerdyakov, I wish you'd marry somebody, or do you want me to get you married? But Smerdyakov only turned pale with vexation without making any reply. Fyodor Pavlovich would walk off waving his hand. So we don't know whether this is because of the topic of marriage or because it comes from Fyodor Pavlovich. But in any case, he doesn't seem to have much interest in the other sex or his own. And about his courtship, just a couple of words about Maria Kondratyevna. There's a kind of a courtship here, and Maria is all agog at Smerdyakov, but let's notice the way that she gets to Smerdyakov's heart. It's by flattering his vanity, and in particular by saying he's like a European, not like a Russian. You're so smart. And then he can vent his resentment in response by saying, if it weren't for my low station, I could have been a contender. Maybe he could, maybe he couldn't. But Maria is love struck, and she says, and you yourself are just like a foreigner and just like a real noble foreigner. I'll tell you so, for all that I'm blushing. Well, she may be blushing, but she is not shy. We can have a modicum of sympathy for Smerdyakov, but this is the basis
for flattering Smerdyakov. And he says, for his part, the Russian people need a whipping, miss. And this, to Dostoevsky, the Slavophile, is not a good thing to say. Okay, want to come to this point, which is the way the narrator describes Smerdyakov, and he describes it in terms of this painting, which is by Kramskoy, Ivan Nikolaevich Kramskoy, 1876. And here's the picture, and here's the narrator's description of it. And I think this goes again to the powder keg aspect of Smerdyakov. He takes in his reflections, and even he doesn't know what they're about. He stores them up, and maybe he will drop everything and wander off to Jerusalem to save his soul, or perhaps he will suddenly burn down his native village, or perhaps he will do both. There are plenty of contemplators among the people. Most likely, Smerdyakov, too, was such a contemplator. Now, Smerdyakov, after the murder, moves out and lives with Maria Kondratyevna and her mother, but I don't think there was any intimacy. And Ivan finally wakes up and says, Ivan Fyodorovich, there was an odd dynamic going on, that Ivan was in a funk more or less constantly, and he couldn't figure out what was it about. Is it about his father? Is it about God? What is it about? And he couldn't figure it out. And then he'd see Smerdyakov, and he said, oh yeah, that's what it's about. And the odd thing is that he has this compulsion. He cannot stop himself time and time again from going back to Smerdyakov. And what he really hates is the familiarity of Smerdyakov with him. So despite loathing Smerdyakov, keeps going back compulsively. So Ivan finally comes to see as having all the worst parts of himself. And this is explicitly what Ivan says to the devil. The devil, as many people have noted, appears in the novel exactly when Smerdyakov disappears from it, seems to take the topos or the place of Smerdyakov in the novel. Why does Smerdyakov commit suicide? I'm going to give you a theory. And that is that Ivan takes way too long to figure this all out because of his own issues. But Smerdyakov needed Ivan even more than Ivan needed Smerdyakov. Why? So Smerdyakov needs to have his ego stroked for how clever he is. And so there's a motif that runs in the old Garnett translation. Smerdyakov says it is good to know clever men. In the more recent PBR and Volokhansky translation, it's intelligent men, but same point. He needs to be considered an intelligent man. And he takes up with the smart alecks like Ivan, who is railing against God's injustice for having allowed children to suffer. And except that Smerdyakov, it's all about his own vanity from having a low birth and all of that. But he needs Ivan, and there is a psychological term that has become something of a cliche, but I think it's appropriate, and if you go back to its origins, it's significant other. The person that you need to be with for your own well-being, for the development of a self. This is from the psychologist Harry Stack Sullivan, and it's a real thing, even if it has become something of a cliche. So even Smerdyakov was social enough to have needed a significant other, and when Ivan abandoned him, that was the end. That was the beginning of the end. So we have a character who is taciturn, unsociable, sadistic from an early age, sociopathic in this, and lacking guilt feelings for theft and murder, probably a parasite, and simply devoid of love and spirituality. The final topic I want to mention his two theological figures with which Dostoevsky associated Smerdyakov in the novel. And they bring us back a little bit to the problem of evil, which is, I believe, a primitive view of evil. And I don't have time to say more, but those two characters or personages are Judas Iscariot and the devil. So Dostoevsky ties the character of Smerdyakov to both of those. Now, Judas suffered the same unhappy fate of killing himself. Not only killing himself, but the same method, hanging himself. So this is one important detail that likens Smerdyakov to Judas. Suicide is a very important motif in Dostoevsky's fiction, and he was particularly upset by what he considered the trivial, forced insouciance of the motives by which people were killing themselves, including the daughter of a literary colleague, Alexander Herzen. His daughter, Lisa, killed herself. But to Dostoevsky, the problem of suicide was directly related to the problem of atheism. Now, Smerdyakov's suicide is not the only detail that links him to Judas. In the Gospel of Matthew, chapter 23, verses 3 to 10, Judas returns the money before he kills himself. So he does that, then he hangs himself. And Smerdyakov doesn't exactly return the money, but he does let Ivan know where it is and tells him, take the money. In addition, Jesus also says to Judas in the Gospel of Mark, woe to that man by whom the Son of God is betrayed. It would have been better for that man, okay, if he had not been born. And this is a theme for Smerdyakov. He says, for example, to his girlfriend Maria Kondratievna, he says, I'd have let them kill me in the womb so as not to come out in the world at all, miss. And then later he says to Ivan, shortly before he does hang himself, he says, well, so kill me, sir, kill me now. He, of course, knows that Ivan won't, but he's got suicidal impulses and wishes he had not been born. Okay, that brings us to the devil, and as quite a few readers have noticed, I've said that already, but the characteristic of what I want to point out about the devil is that that the devil may replace Smerdyakov in the novel. If he's like any character, it's not Smerdyakov. It's Fyodor Pavlovich for being a debauchee and speaking, peppering a speech with French. But the devil, putting the devil into the topos of Smerdyakov strengthens the tie to Judas, because in several places in Gospels of John and Luke, Judas is tied to the devil. So, for example, Jesus calls Judas a devil explicitly in the Gospel of John, chapter 6, and Luke chapter 22, where he alludes to Judas as Satan. And Judas, he says, betrays Jesus after Satan has entered him. And John, one other quote, John chapter 13, number 2, is even more explicit. I'll quote it. I don't have it on the slide, I don't think. The devil, having put into the heart of Judas Iscariot the son of Simon to betray him. So one would think that the devil would be disturbing enough. But let me say one last thing about the devil, which is, what is it about the devil that most disturbs Ivan? And that is that, again, I don't think that he is or is yet fully an atheist. He's experimenting with the idea, but his comeuppance for denying the reality of the spiritual world is to be visited by a spirit. So Ivan insists that the devil is not real, and he's in a real bind, because if he admits the devil is real, then he's admitted the spiritual world. If he doesn't, then he's admitting that he's mad. That's the bind that Ivan is in. And so the devil realizes this, and Ivan realizes it, and the devil says, ah, mais c'est bête enfin, cried the devil, jumping up from the sofa and shaking the drops of tea off himself. He remembers Luther's inkstand. He takes me for a dream and throws glasses at a dream. Now, Ivan imagines that he had thrown a glass of tea at the devil. And then elsewhere, the devil says, spiritualists, for example, I like them so much. Imagine they think they're serving faith because devils show their little horns to them from the other world. Now, the detail of the glass of tea. Ivan wakes up and finds the glass of tea still standing there. But I think Dostoevsky has very cleverly peppered the entire chapter with just enough hints to cast doubt about whether or not the devil was real. But the second reason that Ivan is so disturbed at the devil's visit is that the devil is not grand. This is, if you will, think about Augustine and the theft of the pears. Evil is trivial. Evil is small. Evil is lessening. Okay? Ivan is disturbed that this is not a grand demon. It's just a rotten little devil with a nose cold, out-of-date clothes, and most damning for Dostoevsky, a former serf owner. And I will end with this quote from Thomas Aquinas, which is part of the privative view of evil, that there cannot be a supreme evil. Even the devil is not a supreme evil. And finally, the Smerdyakov, I think, does not have the final word in the novel. Among other characters, one of the things both Augustine and Thomas argues is that God can bring good even out of evil. Their particular examples were the felix culpa, the happy fault, or fall, and the crucifixion, which leads to the resurrection. Now, one can say that Alyosha is the hero of the novel exactly because out of the tragedy of the Karamazov family, this strange young man, to use Dostoevsky's word for him, a descriptor of him, can carry Zosima's message into the world. And I think it's for this reason that Dostoevsky put this quote from the Gospel of John as the epigram of the novel. Verily, verily, I say unto you, except a corn of wheat fall into the ground and die, it abideth alone, but if it die, it bringeth forth much fruit. So, as usual, I have tried to put about twice as much into this talk as there properly should have been, but I am done.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.